나나가오 나나가오
Hey, you're listening to Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Josh. Today on the show, we have some art talk with Juliana and then some music talk with some other folk. A bit of a short one today, but thank you for listening. Really appreciate it. First up, yeah, a little talk with Juliana, a little bit of a backwards interview. So enjoy. CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Hunkamina-speaking Musqueam people. I like that question. Because it's not even like, in part, it is like a question of like the ethics of making art, but it's also like this almost like metaphysical question of like putting other things into the world.
It's definitely both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I like that because the ethics question of like, okay, is it ethical to make art? You know, like that's one question. And I think that that's a valuable one. But it's also a little bit tired. It's also a little bit worn out. Like,
well, it's tired in the sense... It's tired... No, I don't think it's tired. I really don't think it's tired. Because I think it would be tired if we had isolated why exactly art was important. If we had isolated this kind of question of what makes aesthetics valuable, or like what sort of what we draw from it. I mean, I don't like using the word sort of value to apply to anything like that. I think what art making is a bit more ineffable than just it is valuable to us. I don't think it's something that's fully expressible. I think that's why we make art about it and we don't fucking write about it. But where I think the ethics of making art is the most questioned is from a point of view of representation. Whereas, you know, because in an art making practice, what you're always going to be doing is using materials, and like, you know, you'll get like, we'll bitch about this because, you know, art fucking materials are expensive as balls. Shouldn't be swearing in a pre-recorded.
No, no, that's fine.
Okay. Like they're very expensive. I've spent more on like art materials this semester than I have on textbooks, probably for the entire 2 years I've been here.
Yeah,
so like there is that necessary material component to art, and we put up with it because what we're doing is so necessary. But just on top of that, we have to be thinking about the actual environmental and ecological repercussions of what we're doing as more like... You know, when you see art that's being made about these... When you see art, especially these days, that's being made with an environmental perspective in mind. Like... And they're doing it on digital devices that use rare earth metals that have been mined. And, like, this is... I, you know, sort of... came to this realization pretty recently from a reading that I just did for one of my classes. It's called The Anthropocene. So the Anthropocene, but the Anthropocene by Yossi Parikka, I think. I'm not fully sure.
Okay, so not the Anthropocene, but the...
Not the Anthropocene, but the Anthropocene.
Like Anthrop.
Obscene, but...
Oh, cool. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's probably all online.
Like, okay.
It's probably pretty easy to find.
Okay, just do this.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and we really, like, we live in sort of, like, shiny plastic and glass land. We in Canada and Vancouver live in such a gorgeous terrain that we, you know, what we don't see, just like the numbers, it's easy to imagine it doesn't exist. But if you imagine kind of what it takes... to actually get the materials that go into a laptop, it takes minds. Like, it takes minds. It takes human labor. It takes, like, chemical runoff. Like, even the fact that you're using, like, something that is more energy efficient than otherwise, like, what about the efficiency of the extraction process? Like, what about the people who are, like, living in the areas that are being affected by these processes, who are, like, breathing the fog there, who are, like... And this is ultimately because... And then, you know, we're using these materials because they're available to us. And, yeah, we're using them to make art... To talk theoretically about the environment, to create an awareness about the environment, to just play with our own ideas.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Like, express critique.
Express critique. Yeah. But it is a little, it can be a little bit circular, and it can be a little bit, it can be a little bit myopic, honestly, to want to... Just to want to be able to play with ideas. It's another ivory tower. It's another way of playing with ideas. But I feel that it is at least one step closer to being able to actually concretize some kind of beneficial action than just writing about it. Than like it's one more step forward. you know, it's the only step that I see right now. Hopefully, mm-hmm. once I'm, you know, once it's more a part of the way I think and work, then I'll be able to take one more step forward into sort of actual, you know, understanding how to, because ultimately we're all just looking at ways to affect the world
mm-hmm.
around us. We're you know, we're so affected by everything that goes on around us. We're affected emotionally, we're affected, you know, intellectually, we're affected physiologically, mm-hmm. and to be able to turn that outwards, kind of, you know, everyone wants to be able to do that in their work. Everyone wants their work to have a ripple effect.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just a matter of where are those ripples going and what are they doing. And
I think it sounds like the idea that you're putting forward here is that, like, art, with art, you're actualizing, whereas with writing, there's still that just kind
of. I do think there is an aspect of actualization mm-hmm. in writing, but I think it's easier to just. And I'm talking kind of specifically about academic writing. Not that I don't think that academic writing is incredibly important, because mm-hmm. it's, you know, because writing is one of the most accessible, you know, things that one of the media that allows us to access other ideas, without mm-hmm. which we could not do the kind of research that allows us to inform our practices. So I'm not saying that writing is a waste of time. I'm not saying that if that's what you do best and if that's what you're passionate about, that you're just fucking, you're definitely not taking up as much space as someone who makes like 8x10 canvas
right.
portraits of kids. But yeah, I guess what I'm saying is that, I don't know, maybe I've just been divorced from the material world for so long that I am just desperately looking for ways to actually interact with it
mm-hmm.
in a way that makes sense
mm-hmm.
and in a way that can possibly express, you know, because at, you know, and at the same time as you're talking about art with all these kind of highfalutin ideas that it should, you know, be doing something useful and be helping
mm-hmm.
people and be at least addressing concrete things, it is ultimately kind of an expression, maybe not of yourself, but of the things that you're feeling and that you're picking up on and that you feel could be actualized in some way. There is no, like, every different artistic practice, I think, is just an artist learning, is an artist developing their own particular language.
Mm-hmm.
One
of the things you were talking about before was print.
Yeah.
And you're doing print, and that's been a focus, and that seems, I see like that as a particularly, I don't know, there's a certain like particular relationship you develop with material when you're doing print
mm-hmm.
too, that mm-hmm. is like, it's very material in a way.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the other one would be like sculpture. Definitely I want to know what you kind of see in print though. What do you see as fulfilling in print?
Well, any medium is gonna inculcate kind of a relationship with the material. Like, I know that when I'm making art, like, pretty heavily, I've always, like, even when it's just, like, at its minimum, kind of, like, me stocking up on paper, and I have this really special brush pen that, like, it's pretty cheap. It's, like, a $15 pen. But, like, when you're 15, you're, like, this $15 pen that I'm using mm-hmm. specifically for art. And I've, you know, I've lost 8 of those pens. No, I've lost, like, 3 of them. And then when you refind it, but it's still, like, it's such a special pen. And it's, you know, it's, like, the pen. It's, like,
right.
when people pick it up, I'm, like, okay, yeah. they're not going to hurt the freaking pen. You know, like, just, like, the way of ordering your things, the way that you know, like, okay, everything's in this pencil mm-hmm. case, and I'm going to, you know, I'm just going to sit down, I'm going to open my book. And so my brother got me a really nice sketchbook for Christmas, and it's
cool.
just, like, it's one of the only, like, sketchbooks that I've ever, like, pretty much filled. But print in particular is... It's tough because, I'm in the intro course, and right now we're just in the print lab learning to use all the things, and it's just like every 2 seconds the print worker who's a really cool guy, musician too, really cool guy, we're gonna like step out of his office and you're like, what am I breaking now? Like, what terrible, like, what am I getting dirty now? Like, and you know, it takes time. Like, you're on your feet all day. Like, it's different from academic work. I like that because it's on your feet.
Yeah.
You're on your feet. You're moving around. I mean, I remember we were doing intaglio prints for the first time. You know, you have to like buff off the, it's also like a weird, not always intuitive process.
Yeah, there's weird reversals, right?
Yeah, there's definitely weird reversals. So, like, whatever you get, you know you're going to have to wait. You know, you're going to have to wait a tiny bit, little bit for the reveal. And then there are some things that you're like, fuck, like, I was, yeah, I totally wanted that to happen. It didn't come off at all. And then you're like, but just the quality of the everything itself made that look, you know. I know that my drawing quality can be a little bit shitty as long as I think about how the white space is going to be, how the black space is going to be, how the... You know, how I can affect the quality of the guy. I don't really like color, so I don't even think about dipping into the red and the black ink. So black and white is all the tone variation I need. Yeah, so it is a matter kind of thinking about the material as independent to you. You know, you are never going to have full control over your materials. You can definitely get to know them really well. You can get to know the ways that they are likely to act. But you have to know that they're going to be acting of their own accord, and you are never going to be doing more than guiding them in some way, shape, or another. And there are so many different steps to that, to the process. Often, like, you'll, I mean, in everything that I've done, we've started with a plate, and then there's the paper, and then there's the ink. And so at every step of that process, there's room for some kind of variability. You know, you know, a couple of your prints print out badly, and you're like, Ian, like, what did I do wrong? And he's like, oh, well, you know, like, it could be the, you had some buffing on your plate, could be just like, you didn't soak the paper, the water off your paper well enough. Could be this, could be that, could be, but you know, there might be more squooging. And then you're like, oh, can I just throw water on my plate and then put the paper right on it and see what that does? And he's like, as long as it doesn't break the press bed, like, you know.
Right. But, so there's this like chance, this like,
definitely an element of chance. Yeah. Definitely an element of the material kind of self-organizing. Which is interesting, because you, with a lot, with some other, I read a book recently, it was just sort of like an intro little, by a guy named Lawrence, last name started with a K, can't remember what it was, about the Japanese concept of wabi-sabi. It's literally just called wabi-sabi.
Okay.
Like, I can send you the PDF.
Sure.
On Dropbox.
Nice.
Yeah. And it was about kind of this this foundational aesthetic principle in Japanese culture that speaks to beauty that can be found not in this sort of like very clean, very well achieved, very polished, you know, the aesthetic of achievement, the aesthetic of like refinements, let's say, but very much is, you know, is very naturalistic, is very kind of like the aesthetic of decay, the aesthetic of entropy. Not to say that it's morbid. I do think that it celebrates natural forms, both in, you know, in living things and in dying things. But it also just speaks to kind of the, just the naturality, the circularity of processes, the, just the fact that everything is going to take place. You as a person, I feel like I may be speaking past what the aesthetic actually is, but this is what it was resonating with. That, you know, everything is going to take place, and no matter how, and this is also not to knock people who are really technically proficient, people who are really accomplished, because that's its own achievement in and of itself. It's just not, I don't know, maybe I'm lazy. I probably am. But, you know, I love the effects that can be gotten from not fully having that control. I know that, oh man, I went to the exhibits. It was just this, like, very tiny kind of exhibit in the lobby of like the Pacific Rim Hotel downtown, the Japan Unlayered. And another thing I really like is kind of repetitive patterns and kind of pattern, like reticulated patterns, patterns that spread out words, patterns that you can just kind of like draw and draw and draw and draw on, like abyssal, void-like, just like patterns that, I don't know, I'm trying to figure out how to form them a little bit more, but ultimately it's just that kind of like pure, I'm doing hand gestures to kind of emulate the music that doesn't really communicate over radio. Billowing a little bit. Yeah, you know, just I love reticulated patterns, and yeah, drawing those is super sweet. But there was this huge netted piece, this massive netted piece on the wall of this museum. It was in a hotel, so on the wall of this hotel. And I thought it was a painting at first. And it was so complex and so, you know, it looked like a three-dimensional spider web. It looked like when you take marshmallows and you mash them between your fingers and then you extend them, you know, to when you've got that really stringy texture. It was just like white and stringy and extended, but it was two-dimensional pretty much. It was flat-ish, but it looked, you know, it had that depth to it. And I had been trying to draw sort of like netting patterns. I'd been fucking with those a little bit because they're fun. And I just looked at it and I went, fuck you.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah, that moment when you realize it's somebody else's.
I don't care. Like, I love, like, I respect it. And it's inspiring to me. It's definitely inspiring.
But it's also like, fuck you.
It's also like, fuck you, dog. Like, but then I realized that it wasn't a painting. It was a way more interesting process. It was actually this guy. It's still a really long and labor-intensive process, but it was one that wasn't just kind of replicating this incredible surface on a two-dimensional plane. It wasn't two-dimensional. It was this guy had used. Was it bamboo fiber? He had made sort of like a paper-like substance. And he had lain it across this great grid, and it was basically just transforming the natural material of the kind of forest around him into this surface. Like, like when you make paper, you mulch it all up. You mulch it all up, and then you press it. And I think he had used, I can't fully remember the process, I really wish I could to be able to explain better. Something about the process had dissolved select portions of the, had either dissolved select portions of the ultimate paper mulch, or had just allowed select portions to kind of seep downwards so that in the ultimate pressing they weren't as visible. But ultimately, and then he'd like flattened it out and dried it, but ultimately what he was working with was just the natural arrangement of the fibers of the plant fiber. And you know, this was not a pattern that he himself had like seen in nature and tried to recreate, or you know, it was a pattern that was there that he just in some way allowed to emerge that much more palpably, that much more that he just allowed to kind of become salient through this, you know, totally indirect process. So that's
super interesting.
Yeah, and it was so beautiful and
almost like amplified the material.
Yeah, a little bit, a little bit, definitely allowed whatever was. It's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like shining down an ore to get that precious metal. It's like, yeah, you can. Well, I guess. I don't know, because I like the rocky parts of the ore. If you want a nice clean diamond, that's your thing.
It's kind of.
I like patterns more than I like shine.
Okay, let's go back in time.
Yeah, definitely.
Let's do a kind of like printmaking interview style where we go from this to the basics, which are your practice is coming from digital media, coming a bit from print. Tell me about your practice just in the most basic level, or what you're trying to think about right now.
what I'm trying to think about right now. So I would say the digital media was just kind of like a sidestep. Mm-hmm. I just like books, I guess, just because I've always read a lot. Like you know, you've known me at least peripherally for a few years. You've probably seen me reading more than once.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess there's just that kind of very basic attraction to a familiar medium. Artist books in particular, I think, are sweet.
Yeah.
Because what I like about them is they're a lot more direct than artworks that you have to pick them up. You have to pick them up. You have to leaf through them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're often sort of like, you know, a little bit smaller, so you have to, so you can, it's just not as easy to disengage mm-hmm. as it is sometimes when you're just looking at image after image after image. It's, at least there's that tactile quality to it. At least there's that notion that this is, and it's that notion of sort of like a collected thing, a discrete thing. Like images, they kind of bleed into the world around you. Books, you have to open them and you, like, parts of them come out, but parts of you have to go inside. That's what attracts me most. Like, it's like you can't judge a book by its cover. You mm-hmm. don't know what's going to be the most minimalistically painted, like, printed outside cover. You can open it up, it could be like crazy porn, or it could just be like beautiful like flower drawings,
right?
It could just be, you know, it could be literally anything, and you don't know. You need to, I mean, cover has to be something, because mm-hmm. something has to draw you in there. That is really important. It's also the fact that you can mix it with text in a really interesting yeah. way. That's my favorite part. I love sort of like little semi-incoherent, you know, heart. I don't like long narrative poems. I like just like words well placed.
Yeah.
That just like have that punch. I really enjoy that. I like digital media because it's easy to transmit. It's easy to work with. You don't have to buy anything. Mm-hmm. You don't have to, you know, it is more accessible. You don't have to buy anything. I mean, like, Photoshop, obviously, you can buy, but who the fuck buys Photoshop? Like,
yeah.
Whatever. Yeah, if you're glued to your computer anyways, you can, it is, you know, it's a finger click apart. It mm-hmm. demands a little bit more from your brain, fine, mm-hmm. but whatever. It means that you don't always have to carry around, like, a million fucking pens and, like, five mm-hmm. sheets of paper. You can just, like, I could do my homework, or I could make some art. I just got my laptop under my arm.
I would say even with Photoshop, there's that sense where, like, you go into a sort of, like zombie state with Photoshop just as well. Where you just, like, totally. You can be half asleep sort of doing it in the same way that you can just be surfing the net.
Well, it depends, because, like, I can't make art when I'm tired.
Hmm.
I can't make art when I'm not mentally acute. It doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, which sucks, because I'm tired a lot. and like you're like, fuck, I want to fucking, what? I have no ideas. Mm-hmm. I can't even Photoshop. It's like, once you're in there, once you're like already doing something, mm-hmm. then there's like the zombie mode, the repetition, the like, you know, stick some music on and see what's mm-hmm. see what comes out. That's cool. Yeah, mostly I just like the, you know, mostly I just like the same discretion of the laptop. You know, you open up the laptop, it's just a laptop,
yeah.
and it just, and yeah, really easy storage. You don't have to carry anything around. I tend to overstuff my knapsack, so
okay.
it's like the less stuff I can carry.
Yeah.
At the same time, like there are some days when I just don't want to bring my laptop anywhere, and so I just stuff it with, you know, paper and some pens, and it's like, all right, this is actually about the same fucking
yeah.
weight.
Okay,
can't do any
but this came like. Up before we had the mics on, which is
yeah.
this relationship to just too much stuff.
Yeah.
And, like, that bugs you. Has that always bugged you? Or is that something recently that you've started to be like, I don't want to put anything else in this world?
It's definitely something that has always, like, I just don't engage with objects a lot unless they have an express function, unless they are very useful. I don't like there to be too much stuff around me. I accumulate stuff like the worst of them, obviously, but for the most part what I accumulate tends to be like papers or like, you know, sometimes clothing, yeah, pens, art materials, mm-hmm. like things that I like to, that I need to get because I know that they're going into a larger service. Like, I don't, yeah, like, decorations that I have are usually, like, flat, you know,
just, okay,
like,
right.
flat images, but I really try to, yeah, I like a degree of sparseness. I like a degree of just neatness. It, you know, just, it makes you think that, especially kind of, like, living in a fairly, not temporary, I would say, but, like, knowing that eventually I am going to be sort of, like, moving somewhere. It's just, like, I don't know, when people move, it's, like, all the boxes and all the stuff.
Yeah,
all the stuff, and just, like, when you, and, yeah, when you think about just, like, stuff that, you know, it's so easy to just throw something out, just put it in the garbage, and great, it's not your space anymore. Now it's fucking out there in someone else's space, taken up, you know, being just being much, that much more intrusive on the world at large. And it is, yeah, it's just hard to get your mind around the, like, the least of what you can tell yourself when you're making art is, at least this isn't, at least this is unique, at least this is a unique object in some way, shape, or form. Maybe someone will look at it and draw some benefit from it, draw some, have some reaction to it that they feel has been one that perhaps they would not have had otherwise, perhaps one that they will remember, perhaps one that will impact the way they think about something in the future. And if you're really convinced that, you know, you have the power to produce those kinds of effects, then dope. That's awesome. Have fun with your art making. It's hard for anyone who's practicing making things who, you know, who worries about whether what they're making is worth it, or whether, like, their making thing is just, you know, you get trapped into that kind of, like, am I being productive enough cycle of thinking that I think is a cycle that a lot of people are stuck in, like, whether their, like, personal work concerns making physical objects or writing papers or just, like, being on the job market, like, there's this rush towards productivity everywhere, and it's tough to know if that's something that we should let go of a little bit. Like, I remember the other week I was like sitting down and I wasn't immediately sure what I was gonna do for the next while. And I was like, and, you know, there's the little screamer in the back of your head that's just exhausting, going, fucking go up and do some drawings, eh? You know, you have time now. Just do it. And I was like, you know what? There's enough shit in the world. I'm just going to sit here and enjoy it. And when I think of something to do, then I'll do that. But for the moment, just going to enjoy the space. There's space, right? Because space itself takes up space. People don't realize that. Space takes up space. That's why they fucking named it space. It is the essence of space, and we just don't let it be enough.
Hey.
Hey, don't you have to be on your show?
Yeah.
It's 4:10.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay, we should wrap this up.
Okay, let's wrap it
cool.
up.
Cool. Thanks, Jules.
Yeah, for sure.
Appreciate it.
Hey, you're listening to
like Tech that question.
TR 101.9 FM. That was an interview with Juliana Galbraith. Up next, we have a new little interview with Fred from the UBC Thunderbird Marching Band. First, a quick PSA and a content warning. Thanks so much for listening. CITR 101.9 FM.
As a station, we believe in playing content with artistic and cultural merit, and sometimes that category includes material which can be construed as offensive. For those who have children nearby or are sensitive to provocative material, the following broadcast may have strong language, themes, or be otherwise objectionable. Please consider tuning out and revisiting CITR after this program.
Bitch Tapes is a biannual mixtape cassette featuring female-identifying artists from the Pacific Northwest. Their goal is to celebrate female-identifying artists and form a community and coalition of artists who may otherwise feel underrepresented in their local independent music scenes. The release party is March 23rd at the Astoria, featuring performances from Prophecy Sun, Sidewalk Cellist, Julie McGear, Jessica, and Company B Jazz Band. Bitch Tapes is a nonprofit initiative, and funds from the show will be donated to the Downtown Eastside Women's Shelter.
I'm here in the studio with Fred Chalosky, who is the drum major of the UBC Marching Band. He's coming in here today to talk a little bit about the band and what they do. Fred, thanks so much for being with me today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I actually just pulled Fred straight from the Nest cafeteria over here because I saw you guys playing last week in the Nest for Nest Fest. How did that go?
It was great. We had a smaller band, but it was a fun experience really just to get out there and show what we can do in front of the large group that was in the Nest. We had
absolutely
a ton of fun.
Absolutely. And it was kind of like there was like multiple performances throughout the day too. It was like every hour or something.
Yeah, we had two blocks within the span of an hour. So we did 15 minutes, then we took a 10 minute break, and then we did 15 minutes more. And then we came back the next day, of course.
That's kind of fun. Tell me a little bit about the band and kind of what you guys are all about.
So the Thunderbird Marching Band is all about spirit and getting a bunch of people together to play music. We're essentially of two goals. We go out to most athletic games, so basically every week at this point. And we also provide a place for people who don't necessarily want to go through the music school to come together and get a chance to play their instruments, get a chance to be friends with a whole bunch of cool people, and just enjoy themselves. It's a great, great weekly release for a lot of people.
How many times on average are you guys practicing?
We rehearse once a week. We rehearse Tuesdays from 6:30 to 8 and in various places in the Nest, and then we play generally a gig a week. So we'll go to one athletics game a week, or recently we were at Create or at a MOA. We were at the Museum of Anthropology.
Cool.
And so basically it's a twice a week thing.
Cool. And so you were saying that it was kind of like an alternative to maybe more formal kind of music training. What kind of stuff are you guys playing?
We're playing all sorts of things, whether it's our fight songs, which are helping to build the athletics teams up to get going, rah, 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 the traditional marching band stuff. But we have like pop music and punk music and classic rock. You name any kind of genre, we have it in our book just because all of our stuff is done via students. It's all in-house arrangements. And so we have a wide variety of people's wacky musical tastes in the book.
Cool. Yeah. What do you do as a drum major?
I am essentially the musical director or the conductor. I stand in front of the band and wave my hands. That's the thing you see me doing the most. But I also kind of pick the set lists, pick what musical direction we're going into, run rehearsals, help design shows, et cetera, et cetera.
Cool. Do you feel a need to be kind of clued in with the teams and kind of what they're doing? Or do you feel like it's just you're working off their energy?
I am a sports fan too, so I do have a general sense of a lot of what's going on in the sports, so I can kind of get excited with the ebbs and flows of the game. I think that actually helps quite a bit. And I do follow in the background the teams, see how they're doing, see where we could be of help in playoffs and such. So I do keep a little bit of a back eye on it.
Cool. Okay, so what would happen, say, if there's a team that's really just been having a brutal season, just like grueling season, not doing super well? What are you guys going to come in and do?
We're going to just be there for them. We're going to be as loud and energetic as we possibly can be to let them know that, hey, we're here. We support you guys. We love everything that we do, that you guys do. No matter if it's been a rough season, you've had some problems, et cetera, we'll always just be as energetic as possible.
Cool. Tell me about one maybe kind of memorable performance that you guys have done since you've been with the band.
I think I always go back to the marching halftime shows we did, and one in particular was the one that happened last term at football that kind of really came together at the last minute. We had a whole bunch of different pieces that weren't working at certain points, and we kind of had a great team bonding moment where we managed to get a lot of it together.
Okay, so bring me to the beginning. This is a halftime show for a football show. The halftime kind of performance for a football game.
Yeah. So essentially, a halftime show, as far as marching band goes, is that you play a set list of songs while you're marching at the same time. So you're creating different shapes in order to exemplify what's going on in the music. So, for example, our ending song was "Make Me Smile," so you know the last image had to be a smiley face.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
And what were you kind of thinking with the musical direction for that performance?
So I went with the idea of The Summer Never Dies, which is kind of like a little nostalgic look at the summer of 2016. So I had a couple pop songs at the beginning. You have that Justin Timberlake song that no one could get out of their head for a while. You had Alexander Hamilton, because no one could see that show unless they had like thousands of dollars. And Prince, and 1999, because Prince passed away. And so I wanted to kind of wrap up the summer, because it was just happening. Everyone was back at school for the first time in a while.
Right. And what was the prep like for that show? Because you have these formations to do. What were you, the band, doing in terms of prep?
It was kind of incredible, because we kind of had to write the drill at the last minute. Certain circumstances made it so that a bunch of people who I called Team Drum Major, who had kind of really not worked as closely together before, had to sit down in a room for a good 6 hours, sometimes in a pub, sometimes in a nice actual library room. And we sat down on pieces of paper and we all decided, okay, what's the simplest possible shapes we can make and get away with for the show? And it was a really cool experience, because it allowed me to bond with a group of people and really get that sense of collaboration and bring them on board in a new way.
Right. Because you guys are kind of all sitting around a whiteboard or something trying to figure out
this formation. Yeah, we had our little printed out graph paper, you know, the kind you can get online. That's only sort of graph paper. You could hardly see the graphs.
Okay.
And we were just trying to decide what we could do together and what was reasonable. And man, we didn't even have numbers then, so we were having even troubles with that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, so then you try to go and practice it kind of out in the real world with your actual bodies moving. What was that like?
The experience of rehearsing is both really fun and really frustrating in certain points of view. It's really fun because you're getting the band together, and a lot of these people have never marched before. And so you're really getting that experience of kind of learning together and piecing together the different parts. It's also frustrating because we have to use the most alternate means in order to get actual room. Because, you know, this is a big school, but there's not that many open places around here that are football-sized or even, like, basketball-sized.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to get War Memorial Gym just because there's so many teams practicing at the same time. And so we had to find our little corners. We were in front of the Nest, which I'm sure made people very happy at points. We were in a parking lot at one point near Thunderbird Stadium that we kind of got kicked out of. And at one point we managed to get as close to the field as possible without actually getting the field. We were right in front of it, the little turf area in front of Thunderbird Stadium.
So in this instance, you're watching the band move around and you're trying to gauge if the images are actually kind of being rendered in the right way. Is that it?
Yeah. So I stand a little bit higher than they are on the ground. So I will either stand on the stairs in front of the Nest, on the stands at Thunderbird Stadium, and I will be doing my job, which is my practical job is to conduct, but my other job is to make sure, okay, does this look good? Does this sound good? Are we ready to perform this for, at the time, I believe it was September the 30th.
Okay, so how much in advance did you hear about this?
The show itself?
Yeah, like what was the kind of process for getting the show? Was it the team reaches out to you? What does the process look like?
We actually request to the team to do the
show. Okay.
So we go in with a plan to say, hey, we want to do something on the field. It would be really cool for us, and it might be really cool for you to have some sort of halftime entertainment. So about a couple months in advance, I reached out to Gareth, who's our athletics, the guy who coordinates with athletics with us. And I said, okay, here's what I want. I want them like 7 minutes, and this is my plan. And so then I go, I sit down on my laptop, I arrange out the music, which means essentially taking songs from their original format to a format that's playable by marching bands. So I add different tracks to different instruments and kind of mix it so it sounds good with the band. So that takes usually a few weeks, depending on how motivated I end up getting by the end of it.
Right.
And then I will, after that, I give it to the team, and the team decides, okay, what do we want to do with this? Once I get the okay, I send it, we start rehearsals, and I start writing like a little funny script to go along with the music to kind of break up the songs and make
okay, and that's
work.
You, that's you kind of emceeing it?
Yeah, I give it to athletics. They usually yeah. have their MC Nico do it, okay, but that's okay, me cool, kind cool. of creating a little
yeah,
bit
like
of an
that.
Atmosphere
like
for
that.
It.
So what was that? What was this this football halftime show? What was the actual performance like of day of?
I was stressful, but it was also really fun. I mean, we haven't gotten to do anything that big. I mean, we are a small band, but just getting the chance to be on a football field, it's like, yeah, we're really achieving the goal of being like one of those big marching bands
right.
in the U.S., even though we're kind of not at the moment. I got to stand on the most sketchy ladder on the planet, which was also a fun antidote.
Right.
The day of, they got me there, and I asked for a ladder, and they gave me this wooden ladder that looked like it was like 30
oh
years old.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And so standing on top of that was a little stressful, but the performance itself, I thought, went really well, and I think it's something to, in the future, when we get a little bit bigger, to come back and say, hey, look, now we're X size or now we're X size. I mean, I don't think we can quite do a football show again. We're just a little small for that. But in the future, it's something, it's a goal that I hope that we get to reach for at the end of the day.
What came out of this show? I mean, in terms of what were the kind of results? You mentioned that people in the band kind of got more engaged after the show.
Yeah, I just gained a few friends and exec members out of it. My little team drum major, who I hadn't worked with before, we all kind of bonded over that show. We learned a lot of lessons from that show. We kind of were a little less, I'm overly ambitious about a lot of things. And so it kind of pared down my ambitions a bit. We started doing some smaller halftime shows to kind of, you know, to make something more reasonable and more fun for the band in general. It was an achievement, it was a big achievement, but it also taught us a lot, and it also brought a core group of us together. Because, you know, rehearsing, for those shows, the bigger shows, you have to rehearse like 2 times a week, and it's no longer an hour and a half, it's then 2, sometimes 2.5 hours. And it's a real process of bonding and testing in a condensed environment.
Right.
And it brings a lot of people a little bit closer.
Right. I have to say the amount of arrangement too that you're doing prior to the kind of practices, that sounds like require a lot of talent. Like that sounds like really tricky work. What's your kind of background in music?
I have been a pianist since I was the age of 5. I mean, as far back as I can remember, I've been playing the piano. I'm brought up classically. I did all of the RCM, the Royal Conservatory piano repertoire. So whenever you hear like the grades 1 through 10, whenever someone's studying the piano, that's what I did. I really started falling in love with music fully in high school. I was a part of like every band you could possibly imagine in high school, probably to my detriment, but still I kept going with it. It was always something I love. And it's just something that I always love exploring little elements of, whether it's mm-hmm. arranging or conducting or playing the trumpet or playing the piano in different forms. It's mm-hmm. always something that will stick with me.
Did you grow up in Vancouver? What's your kind of image of marching band? Where's that coming from?
My image of marching band entirely comes from this band.
Like, okay, right.
Really, it comes from that. I grew up in Langley, which is a suburb of Vancouver, for my entire life. I have had no sense of any sort of big American collegiate marching bands. I think I saw a few videos in the past and went, oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool to see. But it wasn't until I joined the band here that I got a sense of, okay, this is what that culture is, and this is what that style of band is.
Right. So tell me about the culture. What exactly is it?
It's a lot different. It's marching band culture, as far as I understand it, and I still only have a vague understanding of how it works in the United States. It's that it's like sports culture in a sense. It's band with sport.
Mm-hmm.
So you have like the sport of marching, that kind of physical activity mixed with the musical elements of traditional bands.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like a real merger of the athletics department and the music department.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you really need to be in tune, or maybe even just dictate the energy. What is your kind of strategy for conducting? What is your maybe? How do you conduct?
That's a
you
good
know?
Question. I am just bombastic constantly. I think that's what I would describe as my style. I have learned over time that sometimes it requires a little bit more energy than you think to get it out of the rest of the band or the audience, etc.
Right.
You kind of have to be that big guy with weird hair who's flapping his arms and smiling way too much or doing some sort of weird dance to kind of get people into it. And so that's the style I've adopted over the years. It's kind of helped me get out of my shell a little bit in a sense.
Right, right. Because you kind of have to go out there in front of everybody too. It is really a performance, isn't it?
Yeah, I kind of treat it that way when I